From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
This year, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced changes to the nutrition facts label found on packaged foods. They're trying to make the information more understandable for consumers. We'll sort out just what those numbers on the label mean.
In making the serving size more realistic, it's meant to be representative of what Americans may eat. They're getting a handle on a population that probably consumes too many calories or is unaware of their calories. It's putting a spotlight on those.
Also on the program, pregnancy is a good time to keep exercising or even to get started. We'll discuss exercise options with a baby on board.
And how body donation is important in training new physicians.
All that along with this week's health and medical news right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Tracy, the nutrition facts label, you've seen that before on everything you buy at the grocery store? Well, it's something that is required by the Food and Drug Administration. Now, this label is supposed to provide detailed information about a food's nutrient content, like what's in there, how much fat, how much sugar, sodium, fiber. But sometimes, and particularly for me, and it's always been the case, the labels can be pretty confusing or misleading for shoppers, consumers.
Even for orthopedic surgeons?
Well, probably only for orthopedic surgeons.
Well, in 2016, the FDA announced changes to the label aimed at helping consumers to make more informed choices. Here to discuss nutrition labels and some common nutrition misconceptions is Mayo Clinic dietitian Kate Zaratsky. Welcome back to the program, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, Kate, it's so good to have you here because, you know, I have trouble understanding these labels. The FDA has recently made some changes, and they're supposed to be better. They're supposed to be easier for the consumer to understand.
They are supposed to be more consumer-friendly and more realistic.
Oh, are they? But are they?
Well, and I think that will continue to be debated.
Okay. So what's different? What's new? Why are they better?
So looking at the new labels, what they're going to do first and foremost is bold the number of calories. And so when you're looking at the calories in that particular food, you'll want to compare it to, I guess, first the serving size, because the serving size is supposed to be more realistic. And in making the serving size more realistic and then bolding the calories, it's meant to be representative of what Americans may eat. And so right there, getting a handle on a population that probably consumes too many calories or is unaware of their calories, it's putting a spotlight on those.
And do you think most people in this country know how many calories they ought to be eating a day? And how do you know what that number is?
Right. And that in and of itself is variable from person to person because it really is dependent on how tall you are, what your current body size is, and then what activities you are enjoying or what your goals are in terms of a healthy lifestyle. So that number, although in a lot of nutrition packages you'll see it referenced as 2,000 calories, may or may not be the right number for all Americans.
So where'd they come up with the 2,000?
Well, there is some research to support that most people can maintain a healthy weight at around 2,000 calories.
Men and women?
More so women, with men having a little bit higher number.
So it's just an average. For the average American, the average number of calories.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it will tell you on that label how many calories are in there per serving.
Right. So if the very top of that nutrition facts panel will have a serving amount, and then right below that, it'll have the calories for that serving. And an important point to make is you as the consumer of that product decide, am I going to eat that amount or will I eat more or will I eat less?
That's probably one of the most eye-opening things when you have to start keeping track of that, what the serving size is, because I would imagine most Americans do not eat the serving size. They eat whatever size bowl they have of Frosted Flakes.
Right.
The serving size of Frosted Flakes.
We make comparisons to what our eye is used to seeing. And so actually using some measuring cups or something to reference a portion of a cup is a good idea.
And what else is important to look for on that label?
So additionally, some changes that they made on the label is that in the sugar section under carbohydrates, they are going to add the amount of added sugars, which I think is a real plus because added sugars add sweetness but not a lot of nutrition. And so when we're looking for foods that are more nutritional, having less added sugar, I think, will be a good thing, or at least allowing people to make a more informed decision, because the current labels, you can't tell.
So that's important for something like apple juice. Is that fair to say? Because it's made out of apples, or applesauce, maybe say that. It's made out of apples, but then more sugar is added to it. So you're not counting the sugar in the apples, you're just counting the added sugar? Is that what you're saying?
Right. So if you look at a in a few years, mm-hmm. when you look at a container of applesauce, the amount of sugar that occurs naturally from the apples, which is good, nutritious energy, will be separate than the sugar that they add simply to sweeten it.
Huh. Is that where it says, so I'm looking at a label here, and it has total carbohydrate 12% or 37 grams, and then under that it has dietary fiber 4 grams, 16%, and then it has sugars 1 gram. Is that added sugar?
Currently, it's all sugar. It's all the sugar. So it's the naturally occurring and the added. And so as a consumer right now, we don't know. We can try to discern by looking at the ingredient list, because the ingredient list will, in weighted order, list what's in it first into, by weighted order, what's in it least last. And so if you're seeing many different names for sugar in within the ingredients, chances are there's more added sugars.
So there's not, this label is not out yet.
Correct.
The new ones. And when do you think that will happen?
Well, it's been approved. And so now the food companies will have, I think it's about 2 years, to make the switch over on all their products.
So if you were going to look at a label, an ideal label in terms of a health food, a healthy food, what would you look for? Top to bottom.
So if I were looking for a healthy food, and granted, all foods are different, and so we're looking, but if we were thinking about something in terms of a meal, so say we were looking at something that was meant to be an entire meal, you'd want to choose something that had a reasonable amount of calories. Now, when you think of a calories for a meal, again, making, if we use that reference point of about 2,000 calories, most meals, you'd probably want them within that 400 to 600 calorie range, depending on if you have snacks or not during the day.
Well, you're going to eat three meals a day, right?
Correct.
So it would be like 700, six or 700 calories, right?
No snacks for you, huh? 2,000.
No snacks.
Oh,
no?
Man.
No.
You're a strong man. That's not my deal. I need all snacks.
So all right, 400 to 600. I'm with you in a snack. You get a snack.
So you'd want a reasonable amount of calories. And then what you'll see next on the label is the fat. And so in terms of fat, I think not so much are we worried about the amount rather than we are more so the type. Not that amount doesn't matter at all, because fat is very calorically dense. And so if you're watching your overall calorie intake, it's important to also watch the amount of fat. But choosing healthier fats. And so again, if looking for items that are lower in saturated fat, so if you see the percent across from the saturated fat, you want that number to be lower.
What's low?
So 5% or less would be considered a low number.
Okay.
And in terms of trans fat, food manufacturers have gotten the message that they should remove trans fat from their products. And so we're seeing less of it, but you still may have some trans fat hidden in products. And the best thing there is even go beyond the nutrition facts and look right in the ingredients to see if there's anything that's partially hydrogenated.
Because that's what it says. If it's trans fat, it's partially hydrogenated.
Right. And depending on the number of servings you eat, you might get more of that than you actually realize.
All right. What do I want to look for carbohydrates and protein?
Sure. So in terms of carbohydrates and protein, you want to, carbohydrates are our main source of energy. And so in our overall diet, carbohydrates should range anywhere from about 50-60% of our total calorie intake. So when you're looking at it meal per meal, I mean, you could use that same thing, or you could, you're probably going to see more carbohydrate. And the reason being is because it is our main source of fuel. However, you do want to have an adequate amount of protein in terms of hunger control. So again, if we were looking at this being a full meal, we would want it to have probably 10 to 20% of our protein in order to kind of keep us from wanting to have that snack too soon.
All right, Kate Zaratsky, she's a nutritionist at the Mayo Clinic and dietitian. We've been talking about nutrition facts, and when we come back after a short break, we're going to be talking about some myths with regard to nutrition and your favorite topic, ancient grains.
I do love them, and why are we talking about them at lunchtime? Dang it. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
You know, Tracy, there's been a lot of buzz lately about ancient grains and their possible benefits. You know, stuff like millet and teff and whatever that stuff you talk about every week. That quinoa. You actually eat it, don't you?
I love it.
Well, there may be a place for these instead of traditional grains like wheat, corn, and rice that we grew up on back in Iowa. So we want to talk about those. But before we do that, let's talk again about the new nutrition labels, nutrition facts, and a few misconceptions that are out there when it comes to nutrition.
Yes, our guest is Mayo Clinic dietitian Kate Zaratsky, and we have five misconceptions when it comes to nutrition. One of them we already talked about, which was the 2,000 calories a day.
I would say it's not necessarily a myth, yet it might not be an accurate number for every single person.
Okay.
Another thing that can be confusing for consumers is looking at those percentages that run down the right-hand side of the nutrition facts label, or even any other numbers. None of the numbers necessarily add up.
This is the percent daily value. Exactly what does that mean, and why doesn't it add up?
Right. And so the percent daily value is in reference to the particular nutrient that it's across from. Some of the nutrients, like the fat and the protein and the carbohydrate, are in reference to that 2,000 calorie diet. Whereas things like vitamins and minerals and the fiber, those would be referenced against a reference value. So it might be the DRIs, which is the daily recommended intake, or something along those lines that the Institutes of Medicine sets up.
All right. What about the third thing on your list of misconceptions?
So I think another very important point is to look at the servings that you'll eat in out of any container. Make note of the serving size, and if it says the serving is one container, you know, recognize that rather than if it's half a container. Or
All calories count. That's number four on your misconception list, but I don't understand what that means.
Sure. And I think it's the idea that it can mean a couple different things. Calories count, no matter if it's calories from fat, calories from carbohydrate, calories from protein. And I think that's a common misconception that maybe one calorie is better than the other. Now, when you eat different foods like carbohydrate, protein, or fat, they're going to do different things for you. Carbohydrates give you energy. Protein is great, and actually fat and protein both are really great for hunger control and helping you feel satisfied following a meal. And so they're all very important. In terms of calories, say that if a package says that it's maybe sugar-free or fat-free, and those are very commonly used as marketing tools to think that, oh, if it's sugar-free or fat-free, those are necessarily better calories than other calories. No, it doesn't necessarily mean that. It might be that those calories come from more saturated fat. But
and don't those things usually have the partially hydrogenated stuff in them, the sugar-free and fat-free stuff?
It very well could. Yeah. And if it doesn't have the partially hydrogenated, sometimes they replace it with a saturated fat. And so you have to just really be careful.
All right. And the final thing on your list of nutritional misconceptions?
Sure. The amount of salt that we consume. You know, as Americans, I guess because we live in 2016 and a lot of our food products do come from grocery stores, and so they are in a can, a box, or a package, most of the packaged food we eat contributes to most of the sodium that we have in our diet. And so more than, say, 75-85% of the sodium in our diet is coming from those packaged type products, because salt's a good preservative and it also helps enhance flavor. And so I think people have gotten the message that to put the salt shaker away. However, I think if we could strive to eat a bit more whole foods, where if you wanted to add a little salt, if you're cooking more from scratch, I think you have that liberty.
You know what? I don't think they're ever going to make this easy enough for most people to understand. I think when you go to the store, there ought to be labels on the food, and the first one would say, this is pretty healthy. You could go ahead and eat this. The other one ought to say, you probably shouldn't eat this.
You and want a green light, a yellow light, or a red light?
And the last one should say, this is really unhealthy. You really shouldn't eat this. So, or you follow the cardiologist diet, which is, if it tastes good, spit it out.
Or shop around the outside of the grocery store. I remember that's a lot of fresh stuff, and that's a good way to do it.
You'll avoid a lot of packages if you shop the perimeter.
Okay, now.
All right, your ancient grains.
Well, we had a big debate during a news meeting about ancient grains. Is it all hype or is it a good thing? First of all, for Mr. Know-it-all over here, what are ancient grains and why are they so fabulous?
So ancient grains are grains that probably closely resemble their ancestor of maybe hundreds of years ago. And so they haven't changed much over the course of time.
And why are they hot right now? Is it just hype? They're being used in ingredients lists more, or what's the deal?
Well, I think they're becoming more popular. I could say, you know, maybe we could look at a few different reasons, but one of the reasons might be because people have become more savvy about avoiding either by choice or by medical need to avoid gluten.
Oh,
and
okay.
So a lot of, not a lot, but some of the ancient grains are gluten-free grains because mm-hmm. they're not within the wheat family.
Some of them, but not all of them.
Some,
right?
But not all. Exactly.
So some of those are safe for people with celiac disease to consume, but some not.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to know which is which and which some have gluten.
You still want to look. And actually, we have a list out on mayoclinic.com if people want to reference that.
Is there a benefit to eating ancient grains? I mean, like Tom was saying, there's a long list of things that fall into this. And basically, any grain that you didn't know of before, that's an ancient grain now. But are there benefits to them?
Well, most ancient grains are whole grains.
And that's what you're supposed to be doing.
Right. And so within that category of whole grain, you're going to get the benefits of more fiber generally. A lot of these ancient grains are higher in protein. And so those two combinations right there, fiber and protein, make for a very satisfying meal component. And so they're great to add for that reason. Whole grains are also good sources of many B vitamins, vitamin E. Some have iron, or some more than others.
So they are better than just brown rice or something.
So they do in certain cases. I guess each grain has their own unique nutritional profile. And so you can look at those things if you want more iron or calcium, or if you're looking for anything specific. But they all in general are going to be a fairly good source of fiber, a great source of energy, and some maybe.
How do we add them to our diet?
Sure, and I think you can, and I think this is maybe, again, going back to our original question, why are they such a hot trend right now? And I think when people are looking just for something new and exciting, and maybe not just a rice pilaf. And so the idea that you could use any of these grains, in that fashion or mixed with other foods, but you could also add them as part of a salad or part of breads, and they have different textures, and so some might be chewy or some might have a little bit more of a crunch to them. So, a lot of them have kind of a nutty flavor, and so they do. I think they offer from the, I guess, to your palate, they're very pleasing.
So what do you say to people who tell you that grains make them feel bloated?
Right, and I think, you know, truthfully, if you have not eaten many carbohydrates, carbohydrates by nature, when they are digested, will require a little bit more water. So as you start to eat more grains, you're going to hold on to a little bit more water. And so that's just water, though, and that should flush over time.
Mayo Clinic dietitian Kate Zaratsky, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kate. Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll have some tips on exercise during pregnancy.
And later on in the show, the importance of body donation to help medical students study anatomy. Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. Every year, millions of people get sick from the flu. The virus causes symptoms such as fever, body ache, sore throat, runny nose, and cough. Mayo Clinic experts say the best way to protect yourself from contracting the flu is to get a flu vaccine. But there are other precautions you can take to further increase your odds of staying healthy during flu season. Dr. Vandana Bide says everyone who is able should get the flu vaccine.
You do have to get it every single year.
Dr. Bide says flu shots are very effective, but
no vaccine is 100%.
There's always a small chance you could still get sick. So, in addition to getting the vaccine, Dr. Bide has three tips to help prevent the flu. Number one,
hand washing.
Frequent hand washing to prevent viral infections. And if you do have any kind of infection, whether it's influenza or some other upper respiratory infection, stay home.
Staying home so you don't infect others is number two. Number three is if you get sick, see your healthcare provider within 48 hours of symptoms starting.
Because the faster that you can see the doctor, the faster you can be treated.
But the best way to protect yourself is to get a flu vaccine. And in other news, have you ever had a massage? Doesn't that sound nice? Well, massages really can be good for you. Massage is generally considered part of complementary and alternative medicine. It's increasingly being offered along with standard treatment for many medical conditions and situations. Studies show massage reduces stress, pain, and muscle tension. And more research is needed, but it may also help with issues including anxiety, digestive issues, headache, fibromyalgia, and stress-related insomnia. Massage is not a replacement for traditional medical treatments, but some might find it helpful. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Ah, you're pregnant.
What?
You're pregnant.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, the perfect time to sit back and relax, isn't it? I mean, after all, you're more tired than usual. Your back probably aches because of the extra weight up front.
Yeah, well, unless you're experiencing problems or complications, sitting around probably not ideal. Exercising can help you stay in shape and prepare for labor and delivery. Pregnancy can be a great time to get active, even if you haven't exercised in a while.
Well, here to discuss exercising during pregnancy is family medicine physician Dr. Elizabeth Cozine. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Cozine.
Thanks
always
again.
Good to see you and have you.
Thanks for having me.
And nobody here is pregnant, I guess.
Yeah, we're all safe.
Okay.
Well, it's
there
good.
Are some pregnant women in our listening audience, I'm sure.
There are. And when we invited you to join us, you said this is one of the things that you would like to discuss because you talk about this with your patients.
It is so important.
How so?
Well, you know, pregnancy is a great captive time to see, to encourage healthy habits. You're seeing patients much more regularly, especially young patients, than you might otherwise, you know, kind of every 4 to 6 weeks. And women are also really motivated to do the right thing for their baby. They may not have been motivated to do the right thing for themselves, but but now they've got a baby on board and they're thinking about things they can do to set both themselves and the baby up for success.
So the things that a pregnant woman should do and probably wants to do because of the baby is stop smoking.
Absolutely.
Smoked. You can't drink. Nobody drinks
There's
when
no
they're pregnant anymore.
There's no known
huh?
safe amount of alcohol during pregnancy.
And exercise is good for both the mother and the baby?
Absolutely. And if you have been a regular exerciser, you can just keep up doing what you're doing. And if you have not been a regular exerciser, it's a great time to get started. And you can actually increase your fitness and increase your intensity of exercise during your pregnancy very safely.
Is there something in particular that you should be concentrating on, you know, cardiovascular or weights, or what should you be doing?
So I would first of all encourage just general cardiovascular activity, starting with walking in somebody who hasn't been a regular exerciser, shooting for 30 to 60 minutes, 5 to 6 days a week. If you enjoy that, why not go for a jog? Give it a try. And there's no reason that a pregnant woman couldn't do things like exercise, boot camp style workouts, which are really popular these days, or even weight training.
Are there some types of activity that pregnant women should avoid?
There are a few things that are strictly to be avoided during pregnancy, like scuba diving or really high intensity things where you might...
Now, why scuba diving?
Scuba
diving. But it seemed like you could get down a little faster.
Take advantage of not having to wear a weight belt. Yeah. No, scuba diving is dangerous because of the pressure changes for the fetus.
All right. Yeah. And what other things?
So other things like skiing, paragliding, you know, just basically things that are really dangerous that
things
you might
that
fall.
Teenagers
so,
might do.
Exactly. Yeah. So I wouldn't want you doing something where you might fall and land on the abdomen and potentially injure the baby.
So
I
love contact it. Sports.
Contact
right,
sports.
Right.
What
All
about
right.
weightlifting?
Weightlifting? Absolutely. There's no reason you can't.
No problem.
And we were joking beforehand about yoga. But I love when I'm in a yoga class and there's a mom or two in the room, and that's good for her, I suppose, just because she's reducing stress by going to yoga.
And stretching things out, that, you know, does bring to mind that there are some hormones that can make your ligaments and muscles a little more stretchy during pregnancy. And so just being cautious about what you're doing in terms of stretching and weightlifting, because you might be a little more loosey-goosey than you were prior to being pregnant. But yoga or something like that is great because it allows you to relax, stretch out, and you may find you have to modify your poses as your body shape changes.
Is it important when women are pregnant, women are exercising, or is it a good idea for them to monitor their heart rate? Is there a point at which you would say, ooh, that's 150 or 260 is a little too much?
15 years ago or so, it was thought that heart rate monitoring during pregnancy was really important. What we're finding now is that for the average person, it's really not necessary to monitor the heart rate during exercise. It becomes a little bit of a different story for somebody like an elite athlete. I don't take care of very many elite athletes, but if I did, I'd probably just look up and consult with an obstetrician who has more expertise.
Yeah, so it's good to be young.
Yeah,
they don't have to worry too much about
it. And an elite athlete.
Yeah.
Great. So people who are exercising on a regular basis anyway, they're fine. They can kind of just keep doing what they're doing and it's all good. But when you said, you know, you've got that motherly guilt that already starts off. So where should people start? Do they just start with walking or should they, where should they begin?
I start with walking. I think walking is a great exercise. You can do it anywhere. All you need is a good fitting pair of shoes. You can fit it in short bursts throughout the day. And, you know, with a baby on board, you better start to learn to multitask. So if you can fit your exercise in when you've got a time.
You just feel like sitting down. And so then I was like, it's a good excuse to just sit down. I'm pregnant.
That's absolutely true. It does feel good to sit down. I think it feels even better to stay active. You know, when I was pregnant, there were moments when I did not want to drag myself out the door. But when I did, I felt more like myself. And it is a time when you are changing in a lot of ways, both physically and mentally and emotionally. And by having that stress outlet plus keeping yourself fit, that's just a great way of self-care.
And you can do it right up to delivery.
Yeah, and as you get closer to delivery, you do get a little bit more uncomfortable. You are full of a baby. Yeah. And so things like swimming can be helpful where there's not weight on your body and you feel maybe like you did 25 pounds ago.
Yeah, but just, no scuba diving.
No scuba diving.
You can't go too deep.
You just slow the pace. You slow the roll when you've got that baby and just about ready to go. Are there other questions that expectant moms have for you about exercising?
One question that often comes up is trying to avoid whether or not they need to avoid exercise on their back. And I do say in the second and third trimester, don't recommend prolonged laying on the back, mainly because of the risk of kind of low blood pressure in the mom when she moves up.
Are there certain complications of pregnancy that would preclude a woman exercising?
Yeah, I think so. So if you are somebody who has had a history of preterm labor, or you're having regular contractions, you're having loss of fluid, those would be reasons I wouldn't want you exercising. I would want you to talk to your doctor immediately if those things were happening. But there are very few reasons that you can't exercise during pregnancy.
If a woman's blood pressure starts going up, I assume that exercise is probably good.
Yeah, I would say. Yeah, absolutely. Exercise can help keep the weight in check. And regular monitoring with your doctor is important if your blood pressure is going up during pregnancy.
You know, it's been a long time since I went to medical school. What do you recommend in terms of weight gain for someone during pregnancy?
So the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the Institute of Medicine agree that for somebody with a normal BMI, the weight gain would be 25 to 35 pounds during pregnancy. As you get into the overweight weight range, and don't quote me exactly on this, but it's more 15 to 25. And then for an obese woman, we don't want her to gain more than 15 pounds.
Hmm. Oh, wow. So 25 or 35 pounds.
That's where I try to keep people. And I do focus on that during prenatal appointments, just being aware of it. You know, not everybody gains weight linearly during their pregnancy, not just a pound a week. You know, I knew there were weeks when I shot up 5 pounds and then didn't gain again for a month. But just paying attention to what you're doing to try to stay within that weight window is both good for your recovery and good for the baby.
All right. Try not to gain too much weight. And exercise is key, even if you're pregnant.
Thanks, Dr. Cozine.
Thanks so much.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio,
how body donation is important in training new physicians.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Anatomy is the study of the structure and function of the human body. Oh, well, I remember. Days or months or two semesters, I think, we had of anatomy. But it is truly one of the most important courses in the education of doctors and physical therapists and a lot of other healthcare professionals.
Body donation plays a critical role in helping medical and health-related science students to master the complex anatomy of the human body and provides researchers with an essential tool for discovery to help patients.
Well, where do the bodies come from? Here to discuss body donation is the coordinator of the Bequest program at Mayo Clinic, Mr. Sean Heath. Welcome to the program, Sean.
Thank you.
To have you.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for having me here, Tracy and Dr. Shives. I appreciate the opportunity.
It is kind of a strange job that you have, or not? Do you think there's nothing strange about it at all?
Well, there are some aspects of it that are a little unique, and there's not very many opportunities to have this ability to provide this type of opportunity to the medical community.
Now, this radio program is heard on 90-plus stations across the country, and so it's a little bit unique to the Rochester, Minnesota area that there are probably more people, percentage-wise, who consider donating their body to science. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And I think it's fair to say, too, that because of the scope of Mayo Clinic and the patients that travel here from all over the country, that we have a great deal of interest across the U.S. in body donation. And because of that, we do, unlike many other programs throughout the United States, do accept donors who want to bequest their body from all across the U.S. And so it just allows us to be able to fulfill the wish and scope of what Mayo seeks to do in terms of reaching the community outside of the Rochester area.
Don't you find it sort of interesting that there are as many people as there are who want to do this?
Absolutely. And there's several reasons for that. And one of them, and the most important, is because they have been affected by Mayo Clinic in terms of either themselves, the healthcare that they've received, or a family member. And it's the compassion and the impression that they get when they meet all of the employees here at the clinic that strikes them. And for many of them, that's what motivates them to want to donate their body to Mayo Clinic.
And I don't even know exactly how the process works. I mean, if a patient of mine said, you know, I want to give my body, donate my body to Mayo when I'm gone, how do you do that? What do we contact you?
Sure. Sure. And so that's a good question, because there are many folks who put this in their advance directive or their healthcare directive.
Oh, okay.
And they make the notation that they want to donate their bodies to science. We do have a specific consent form for our program at Mayo Clinic. And it's important to know that there are some aspects about what we do in terms of body donation here that may make the decision for some whether they want to do this or not. When you say donation, it can mean so many different things. Mm-hmm. And we just want to be clear of what we do and what our limitations are so that the family and the individual who's doing this is comfortable with that.
What actually happens to the body? You know, when a person dies, mm-hmm. If it doesn't go, I don't know what you want to say, the traditional route, but what happens to the body, and then how long is it used?
Sure. Well, our length of study can be anywhere from 6 to 15 months. And that is completely dependent on the curriculum that we have going on and also the medical conditions of the person who passes away. And so often what we do, the vast majority of what we do in our area is procedural skills training. And that entails anything from teaching orthopedic residents how to do knee arthroscopies or other joint replacements to teaching internal medicine residents how to do thoracentesis or paracentesis. And so those are
operations on the heart and the lung.
Correct.
Get the fluid out from around the lung. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And those
procedures.
Right. And those are just two examples. We serve almost every specialty throughout the clinic in terms of training, product development, educational purposes, those sorts of things. And so that's a vast majority of what we do. Although we do the gross anatomy, the more foundational aspects of learning how the body works and functions, but I would say 85% of what we do is more catered to the direct patient benefit in terms of the day-to-day aspects of what the staff and the residents and clinicians do that will help better prepare them for patient care.
So does a student just use a body during that course of time, whatever many months you just listed, whatever it ends up being, then what happens to the body?
At the end of our educational studies, we do offer a form of cremation right within our facility here on the clinic campus. And if the family so chooses, we can provide that service of cremation and then return the cremated remains either to the family, or we do have cemetery property here at Oakwood Cemetery in Rochester.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, that the medical students don't do the dissection of the entire cadaver like we did when I went to medical school, right?
Well, some do. And so the different curriculums that we have, the medical school does use the entire body. They go through all the organ systems, the upper limb, the lower limb. They're trying to learn everything. The other curriculum that we have, the physical therapy, obviously they're more focused on the musculoskeletal system and learning the muscles and the ligaments and joints and things that they'll need to do when they see patients. And so in terms of the resident training, the more procedural skills type of events that we do, that's more specialized. And so we're able to have more of those departments involved in the body because they're more focused on one area or the other in terms of their curriculum or what they're hoping to study.
Yeah, it's incredibly beneficial, incredibly helpful to medical students, to physical therapists, and as you mentioned, to learning how to do certain procedures, to actually do it. There is no model that's as good as the human body.
That's correct. And there have been studies here through different simulations and trainers that there really is no way to replicate that experience without the use of people who donate their bodies.
Dr. Shives, did you know the name of the person that was your body that you used in your medical school?
No.
Did they tell you that?
No, we never did. We had names for them. Mm-hmm. We named them, but it was always very respectful. I think all the medical students are very respectful of the bodies that are donated because you realize how important it is to your education. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, and that's still true today, we wouldn't
know
the name of the donor, would we?
We do disclose the first name of the donor,
okay,
along with their age and their occupation. And that helps the students make that connection with their donor. Because as they're going through their curriculum, they're wondering, who is this person? What did they do? Obviously, they have family. They have brothers and sisters and a spouse. And so as they think about that and they think about their own mortality, in addition to what they're trying to learn, it helps make that connection because it is their first patient.
So how many bodies in your lab right now?
Well, and that varies from time to time. But in the course of a year, last year we had 217 donors. And they're all in various states of how they're used because of the different curriculum that goes on. So,
do you have more donors than you need?
Well, currently, no, we are still in need. But we are registering approximately 700 consents annually. And so our need, which is about 217 to 219 per year, down the line, if that number of donors that registered passed away in the course of a year, we may not have that opportunity to use all of those bequests in that period of time.
Let's go back to our 94 radio stations, and someone in Maine wants to give their body to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Is that even possible?
Absolutely. It certainly is. There's a few things to know about that. The first and most important thing is to make sure that that consent is in place. Second is to inform your family of what your wishes are, because if they don't know what you want to do, it won't happen. And if you do want to do that, the thing that will need to happen is a relationship with a local funeral home, and they will be critical in terms of helping to coordinate the transportation to Minnesota. And there also is some cost. And generally, the further that you get away, there's going to be some cost to your family. But there's no distance that's too far away to not make this happen.
All right, Mr. Sean Heath, coordinator of the Bequest program at Mayo Clinic. Thanks so much for being with us. We learned a lot.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks for having me.
That's our program for this week.
For more information, visit the Mayo Clinic News Network for today's podcast and previously aired programs.
Tweet us your health and medicine questions anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or email us at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu. We may answer your question during an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.